C+4. Ford Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. As a gloomy afternoon in Birchwood finally gave way to the full darkness of night, Dan sat attentively on Emma's couch with Tara by his side. The wall-sized image from Emma's projector illuminated an unusually messy living room, empty pizza boxes, soda bottles, and all. But no one cared. Rooster made a home for the night next to one of the boxes, settling for the better-than-nothing smell of pepperoni after eating his own comparatively boring dinner. Emma was in her bedroom, face down in the dark, but passively awake, despite Dan and Tara's full belief that she was asleep. Clark had gone to the bar with Henry, not having decided to ignore the no drinking in public without the other one present rule that he and Emma used to live by, but instead having understandably forgotten about it following a trying day marked by such horrible discoveries. Dan remembered the rule and told Clark to make sure he didn't say anything about anything to anyone. But he knew Clark wouldn't so much as open his mouth to discuss anything besides football and the other standard fare among Phil Norris and his bar's regulars. Timo Fiore, for his part, had by now had the entirety of his extensive luggage delivered from the Gravesen Hotel in Colorado Springs, given his preference for staying with his new inner circle in Birchwood rather than alone in the hotel's plush suite. Dan McCarthy's basement was certainly a great deal cozier and significantly more Spartan than the standard of accommodation Timo was used to, but the bed was extremely comfortable, and his friends were nearby. Until such time as things calmed down and he could check out potential homes near the Fiore Frontieri headquarters in Colorado Springs, Timo was content to stay in Birchwood for as long as Dan would have him. His long-term reservation and the hotel's discretion ensured that the media believed Timo to be holed up in a suite at the Gravesen, while the security offered by the signal-blocking properties of the basement's layered walls helped him sleep more soundly than usual for reasons he didn't give much thought. Dan's wired connection to the rest of the house, meanwhile, gave Timo full internet access on his own secure laptop, to which all calls and messages intended for his phone were automatically forwarded, while it lay in a secure compartment on the outside of the basement's door. Tara was disinterestedly playing around on her own phone, feeding virtual farm animals and harvesting virtual crops. She would make a joking or biting comment about someone on the TV every now and again, drawing a smile or a laugh from Dan. Dan was finding Tara increasingly easy to be around, which made sense, given that she came from the same genetic pool and nurturing environment as Emma. The relationship dynamic between the sisters had initially confused him, with Emma seeming to have very little time or patience for Tara, but both that impatience and Tara's apparent penchant for saying things to try and get a rise out of Emma had steadily faded over the last few days before the news of the comet ushered in a full detente. As Dan skipped through the ads on a recording of the previous Sunday's Focus 2020, an episode whose threat-related discussions now seemed chillingly prescient, a commercial featuring one of Tara's former close colleagues caught her eye. She asked Dan to pause the recording and leaned back. "That was supposed to be me, you know." "Yeah?" Dan said. He didn't know anything about high-end cosmetics, but even he recognized both this brand name and the model advertising it. "What happened?" Tara shrugged a somewhat regretful look on her face.
"I didn't want to do it. This might sound shallow or whatever, but I think I'm one of those old-fashioned people who's happy to be rich without being too famous. A year ago, I wouldn't have believed there was such a thing as too famous, but even the tiny little bit of fame I had in my industry changed how people treated me, and that's without even thinking about all the crap I get online. I honestly don't know how I could live like you or Emma, with every single person recognizing me. Wherever in the world I went to try to get away from it. I look a lot like her if you look for the similarities, or obviously if I'm deliberately made up to look like her, but random people don't stop me in the street and say, 'Hey, are you related to Emma Ford?' or anything like that. So yeah, I didn't want to do it. I mean, part of me did, because it's not always easy being in her shadow all the time."
"I wouldn't say you're in Emma's shadow," Dan said. "It's not like you're in the same industry or anything."
"Yeah, but there's a lot more to it than that. I don't know how it was with Clark or anything, but Emma has had her shit together since she was like 17. Then she just moved away, went for what she wanted and got it. That's not exactly easy to follow, and obviously I'll be happy if I'm still alive in a year's time once this comet is out of the picture one way or another, but I have literally no idea what I'll be doing if I am. I burned so many bridges when I was in New York. There's no way back on that front.
Dan didn't know what to say. This wasn't exactly his forte. But he could see why Emma had spoken to him a few days earlier about how Terra seemed to have grown up a lot in the past year. Emma explained that Terra used to be a real challenge to keep in check, which was why she wasn't initially too hot on the idea of her coming to town for an extended stay, and Dan could definitely see something of a change in Terra, even though he hadn't previously known her very well or for very long.
"I'd say you're doing more than okay," he eventually said. "And you were smart enough to know what you didn't want to do, which is a lot more than most people can say. You'll figure something out soon. And don't worry, we'll all be alive to see it."
"And if I don't figure something out, I guess I could always just stay here and sponge off you guys,"
Terra replied, laughing out loud as she brightened up and encouraged Dan to unpause the TV. The subject matter on Focus 2020 really did hit close to home, with Timo himself having spent much of the second segment stressing the potential dangers of an impact from space. The great irony, of course, was that he, along with everyone else who knew about Il Diavolo, now desperately hoped that he'd be proven very wrong in his claims that the GSC was woefully unprepared for such a threat. The discussions seemed so prescient that Dan imagined that when news of the comet was eventually released, members of the public would have a difficult time believing that Timo hadn't known about it before appearing on this panel. "The GSC isn't ready for these types of threats, and they're not necessarily far out." Timo's voice rang through the projector's unseen speakers as the recording played. "In the last few years, we've seen a comet pass within 1/30th of a solar distance just 2 months after its initial detection. And as for Chairman Godfrey's recent claim that the GSC has mapped all potentially dangerous asteroids, well, if that's not the height of arrogance, I don't know what is. Anyone could say they've done an extensive survey of their garden and that they're confident they've detected every squirrel inside the property boundary. But what about the wolf on the other side of the fence, just out of sight? What about the cheetah on the other side of town, who could be here in 5 minutes? You can count the sparrows who sit in the tree all afternoon, but what about the vulture who flies overhead once a day? Acting like you can map all space-borne threats is madness of a kind I can barely fathom. If this is what other people think, then Billy was right. We truly have lost our humility." Billy Kendrick then spoke up in support of Timo's stance, and his comments hit even closer to home. "An asteroid coming in from behind the sun would elude standard detection measures, and that's before we even talk about comets. With our detection capabilities being what they are, a long-period comet with the right kind of orbit, or the wrong kind, more to the point, could come in pretty much before I finish this sentence. And, well, that would be it. Finished. Here lay the human race. No one thinks about comets. In popular culture, we see great comets going past the Earth and think that they always will, whereas whenever we hear the word asteroid, we start worrying about whether it will land. We probably all remember Comet Hale-Bopp," Billy went on. "That was widely considered the comet of the century, but it was discovered just 10 months before it became visible to the naked eye, and the people who discovered it first were amateur astronomers. The sky is a big place, a big, big, big place, and things move quickly. For smaller threats that could cause serious damage and widespread death without destroying our whole world, there's really very little reason to assume we'll have any warning at all. Just a few years ago, the Chelyabinsk meteor in Russia exploded with far more force than the one we saw last week at Kerguelen. That Russian meteor was the biggest natural object to enter our atmosphere in over 100 years, but we didn't even see it until it was already here." Dan couldn't miss the irony that Billy, something of a forgotten man in his consciousness of late, was yet to learn just how right he had been in suggesting that it was unwise to ignore comets when discussing possible threats from above. One panelist who either knew already or would find out very soon was Jack Neal, by virtue of his sycophantic attachment to the leader of a GSC primary member state. Dan expected that Jack, a man he would love to forget about forever, was sure to climb down on his threat that John Cole would pull the UK out of the GSC if Godfrey didn't get his act together.
For now, that a real threat had emerged, a detente between Godfrey and Cole was almost as necessary for global stability as that which had already occurred between Godfrey and Timo was for the planet's very existence as a viable ecosystem. The panelist whose rationality Dan felt least confident in depending on was Joe Crabb. A longtime ally and friend of Richard Walker, Crabb's shock-jock instincts knew no boundaries. To date, Crabb had stayed quiet about the botched interview with Richard Walker he'd attempted to conduct a few days after this episode of Focus 2020 first aired, and the media had long since moved on, having dismissed it as a cheap publicity stunt for Crabshoot Radio. But a throwaway comment Crabb had made during his Focus 2020 appearance, which no one took seriously, was illustrative of the kind of paranoid and potentially dangerous nonsense he was willing to spread.
Does anyone really trust Godfrey's GSC not to divert an asteroid our way to get rid of the troublesome American thorn in their side?
People like Joe Crabb, of whom there were mercifully few, thrived on attention and would say whatever they had to say to attract and retain it. Should the comet's approach become public knowledge, Dan knew that these could prove to be the most dangerous people of all. But the part of the show which troubled Dan most on this second viewing was a part which had sparked feelings of vindication at the time. The public revelation of an internal GSC memo whose signatories claimed that their analysis of the Kerguelen bolide suggested it was an observably unnatural event. Rather than the content of that so-called GSC leak, what bothered Dan was its very existence. The glee in Billy's voice as he gloated about this leak, one which Emma and Timo had actively facilitated, would certainly not be in keeping with the type of reactions which would follow if anyone inside the GSC leaked knowledge of the approaching comet. Troublingly, Dan wasn't sure whether the hatred some GSC staff harbored for Godfrey would be enough to push them towards a spiteful public revelation. Every time Dan now heard Billy calling for full disclosure, the phrase, "Be careful what you wish for," lingered at the front of his mind. Dan himself wrestled with the dual meaning of the term full disclosure quite often. While Billy and his ilk used it in vague reference to some unspecified data they believed the GSC was hiding, Richard Walker had previously and independently used it to refer to a hypothetical public revelation that the IDA leak and the supposed cover-up which surrounded it were in fact component parts of the greatest hoax ever devised. Dan had never imagined that anything would come along which could cause more societal damage if revealed to the public than the hoax. But the discovery of Il Diavolo was quite possibly just such a thing. He hoped beyond hope that anyone with sufficiently high security clearance to be in the loop would be intelligent and responsible enough to bite their tongues for at least the week or so it might take for the GSC's primary members to desperately hammer out some kind of plan. But Dan's own time in the spotlight, during much of the previous year, had taught him that intelligence and responsibility couldn't always be reasonably expected from those in positions of authority or entrusted with combustible information.
"How long are we going to keep the plaque quiet if nothing happens?"
Tara asked as soon as the closing music hit and the credits rolled at the end of the show. Dan turned to her, surprised by the suddenness of the question.
"Because there might be a lot of complacency if people think the messengers are going to help," she went on. "And people might expect them to help since they don't know as much as we do. They don't know we found this thanks to a warning from the messengers."
"I know what you mean," Dan said. "And if nothing quickly comes out of whatever discussions the GSC member states are going to have, we'll do what we have to do. Timo isn't sure, but he thinks Godfrey is going to announce a formal GSC summit tomorrow morning, without saying what it's about. Everything like the California fireball and the protests about the Kerguelen memo he tried to suppress actually provide a pretty good cover for having top-level political and scientific discussions about the comet." Tara nodded slightly.
"Obviously, I hope they come up with something, but I'm glad to hear you're not totally against ever telling people about the plaque, because if people don't know it's a warning, then they could be hoping for some Deus Ex Machina moment of the aliens coming down from the stars to save us at the last minute, which we know isn't exactly likely. I mean, from what I can see, they're not coming to save us."
Dan shifted in his seat, suddenly deep in thought.
"I went to college for 4 months,"
Tara continued with a smile, thinking he was impressed by her turn of phrase.
"And that's 4 months longer than you, so don't look so surprised when I start breaking out the Latin."
Deus ex machina is Latin, but it comes from Greek, Dan said. It means something like God from the machines, and it's from old theaters where...
Where the guys playing gods were hidden above the stage, Terra interrupted. I know. They would hang on strings out of sight. Then at the end, they would come down and take care of everything to wrap the story up all nice and neat. Latin, Greek, whatever. And obviously the real aliens aren't gods, but if people think they're going to come down and rescue us, then it's pretty much the same. Hoping for that isn't necessarily a bad thing, but expecting it?
If that kind of thinking comes up, we'll put it down, Dan reaffirmed. After a long pause, Terra asked another question.
Do you think they'll save us? If it comes to that, I mean?
I think they might, Dan said. But we really can't count on it. It could go against their notion of minimal necessary intervention. I mean, I don't know why they would warn us but not save us, but to them it might make some kind of sense. That's the problem. It's not just a case of us trying to make sense of what they're doing by assuming things about their psychology. The compounding factor here is that whatever they're doing is based on their assumptions about our psychology. They said they had never taken anyone before Walker. The first time they took him, that is. So that means the only people they've ever directly communicated with are Walker, me, and Emma. So if they're trying to judge how we'll react to this, I don't know whose psyche they might be assuming is normal. Mine? Emma's? Walker's? Or maybe a broader view based on their general observations of how groups of people have dealt with certain things in the past? There are so many assumptions on both sides of the question. It's like, I don't even know. It's not like anything. It's just a giant mess.
But still, Terra mused, her tone suddenly slightly more upbeat. At least they warned us.
Dan's expression softened at the simple truth of Terra's statement. I'll tell you what, though, he said with an ironic grin. I sure as hell wouldn't mind if someone from Fiori Frontieri turned up at the kitchen door and came inside to tell us that the comet is a hoax. Terra laughed for the first time in too long.
Seriously, though, she said. If you're getting down about what's happening, you need to remember something. Without you falling for Walker's hoax, and without you and Emma and Clark and Timo pushing so hard last year to get the story out and to make people believe it, we wouldn't know about the comet. Il Diavolo would still be coming, but we wouldn't know. The messengers wouldn't have come here at all if it wasn't for DS1, right? Because they only got involved to stop us from putting nuclear weapons in space. Then after that, they had to clean up the mess, so they called you to that cornfield. And without that line of contact, they couldn't have quietly told humanity about Il Diavolo. Do you see what I mean? I don't know. This makes sense in my head. Like you said, I'm trying to make assumptions about them, but it's impossible to know what they think about us.
Don't forget that without you recognizing Smeltertown from that episode of American Treasure, we might not have found the plaque as quickly as we did, Dan said. And one thing we know for sure is that every day counts.
I just wish there was something else I could do.
Terra sighed.
Something else we could do.
Dan wished the same thing with every fiber of his being, finding his current level of frustration worse than any he had known before, precisely because it was such an oppressively helpless kind of frustration. The previous year, when he believed that the hoax was a cover-up, he had at least understood the selfish motives of the people he was up against, and had woken up every day with a burning desire to show them up for the liars they were. That things had turned out to be a lot more complicated than that didn't change the fact that Dan had been able to follow a sequence of steps, difficult as they were, with reasonable expectations of what might come next. But now? Now none of that could be said. Dan couldn't begin to understand the messenger's motive for warning humanity without actually helping. And from where he was sitting, there was no obvious path forward. Deep in thought, he said nothing.